Roland Flint has traveled literally around the world to come and be here tonight. And he's just gotten, well, I don't know if it's halfway or if it's all the way, but he's just come from New Zealand. And he is, let's see, the author of Say It and Mourning, The Honey and Other Poems for Rosalind. And he's going to have a book called Resuming Green, Selected Poems, which will be published in March by Dial Press. He also received this year an NEA grant, which is a fellowship in creative writing. We're really pleased to have Roland Flint here tonight. And I think that's all I have to say. So enjoy. What? The score? Oh gosh. I'm sorry. I forgot the score. The baseball game. We're winning 4-0. What inning is it?
Six.
The sixth inning, so we might win, folks.
Score.
Is this one off? Thank you, Jan. I'm going to read about a half hour, some poems from each of the first books and some new poems, most of which will be in the new book Jan spoke of. The first poem is called Skin. If the wood is good grain and the carpenter, the fit, the caulking, the cask will be good. And if the grapes are good, the wood and the wine will improve each other in the dark long days of aging. The separate tastes of earth will taste again and change again each other until, like membrane, somehow in and between the wood and wine, there will be no separation, wood from dark, from wine. When this goes on, anything can happen. Go back to mystery. Now I am grateful to my small poem for teaching me this again, that my God is still the moment where the wood is no longer itself, where the wine is no longer only itself. Can you hear me way in the back? This is called Follow. I think it's less a religious poem than it's a poem about the audacity of the storyteller. It's called Follow. Now here is this man mending his nets after a long day, his fingers nicked here and there by ropes and hooks, pain like tomorrow in the small of his back, his feet blue with his name, stinking of baits, his mind on a pint, and supper, nothing else. A man who describes the settled shape of his life every time his hands make and snug a perfect knot. I want to understand, if only for the story, how a man like this, a man like my father in harvest, like Bunk McVeigh in The Stench of Lobstering, or a teamster, a steel worker, how an ordinary working stiff, even a high-tempered one, could just be called away. It's only in one account he first brings in a netful. In all the others he just calls, they return the look or stare, and then they straightaway leave their nets to follow. That's all there is. You have to figure what was in that call, that look. And I wouldn't try it on a tired working man unless I was God's son. He'd kick your ass right off the pier. If they had been vagrants poets or minstrels. I'd understand that. Men who would follow a different dog. But how does a man whose movement, day after day after day, absolutely trusts the shape it fills, put everything down and walk away? I'd pass up all the fancy stunting with Lazarus and the lepers to see that one. I love the applause, but if you applaud every time, then I can't read as many poems as I want to. And if you ever don't applaud, I'll be in grief. I was talking with friends at dinner about coming from New Zealand and about the fact that it's just turning spring there, as it's just turning fall here, and what other differences that involves, differences of perspective. And one of my friends said, and we were talking about how a slight difference of perspective can change entirely how one sees the world, and one of my friends says, it turns you right around. And that's what this poem is about. And I can't resist reading it after this exchange. It's called Turn. And it's about season two. When I lie under the tall trees at this time of year, no leaves yet, but the buds ready to break. When the separate winds make whole branches move, drift, return, sway, I see every possible thing is here, from the first stir of creation to the slow, unwinding, hieratic floods. Branches the shapes of grief or expectation, infantile and ancient in the same knot, branches naked as roots. And I dream the branches into roots, turn the worlds around. Try to imagine in what underground sea, in what floating skies of humus, the rooted branches drift, dreaming. Into what clouds of anthracite they stare, the seaweed branches waved into the nitrogen-silent water. It makes me believe again in mirror versions of the universe. Somewhere another poet writing this, lying on his back, facing the lovely, unchanging secret at the center, wondering the other world, dreaming his dream of me. This is called His Good Time. Seems appropriate to read it here. It's the only poem I got from my longtime bartending. I tended bar about 5 years, and seems the right place to read it. This incident happened. I didn't write about it for 4 or 5 years. I was fascinated by it, but it never occurred to me to be a poem until one day when I was cutting the grass, and it seemed very much to me to be a poem, and I went and wrote it down mostly. There are only a couple of lies in it. The old man was not Greek, he was Czech, but it worked better for the poem. I don't know if the young man and the young woman were respectively his son and his wife and having an affair under his nose, but so it seemed to me. At one point in the poem begins, "Where is his mind?" And at one point in the poem, I try to guess where his mind is, and that it's broken and faltering. And on the page there are dots to indicate that. And I'll just pause a little and hope to suggest it. At the end, I try to suggest that the surprise on their faces at his residue of strength might be like the surprise on the faces of those men who are trying to take Penelope and Odysseus's land. Remember when Odysseus comes home and strings the bow. They've left their weapons outside, and they know they're dead men. I try to suggest just that look of surprise. I also have a poem about introducing poems too much, and maybe I'll read that. His Good Time. Where is his mind, the old Greek farmer at the bar? His son and young wife stand while he sits, drinking from the bottle with closed lips. They know he's crazy, and mugging, they tell the bartender, who is looking up from the glass the old man shoved away. He doesn't speak, but he buys the round. They flank him and watch the coin purse unpuckering when he squeezes it like something obscene. Crazy, but he holds the money and knows amounts. Therefore do his kin stand ready, contemptuous but patient, as he presses his index finger to his ear, his cheek, his nose, or holds it up and looks at it, smiling, sucking his beer, and humming. He dreams the footpaths in Crete, the contrition of a young wife, her head held so, the caves of the sea at night, his catechism, a son born in the cave of sod, the endless earth of North Dakota, the clapboard rising at last in the sea, the blade breaking into new ground, his ground into her head held so, his last wife. And she stands patient now as he presses his ear, cheek, nose, or hums to his finger a vague falsetto, deeds, documents, and unforgivables with the coin purse in his breast. They've known his mind is gone since they found him in the cold night wearing only his long johns, a pitchfork in his hands, cleaning the barn in the dark. They watched him and laughed with relief, the old man grinning back and nodding emptily. But he surprised them by keeping a hard, clear place for the money, paying bills in cash, not speaking. This is his good time, out of hurt, but in charge, before someone whispers, power of attorney, and someone will. But what did their faces do the first time they tried to take him, and he blazed up clutching that coin purse? Odysseus, crazy, dressed like a bum, and stringing the bow. I've been told this is a sexist poem. I don't think at all that it is. It's called Sword and Sheath. Peter Clemens said his song was about two American preoccupations, going for a drink and taking the dog out. This is about fucking and killing. Two other American preoccupations. I think, in fact, it's about the right and wrong uses of that energy. It's called Sword and Sheath. By the way, I think it comes down on the side of one of them rather than the other. Sword and sheath. One, many ancients, Sophocles, Lucretius, have called the thigh's rich loam a place to plow or war. Two, some Puritan ladies wore a certain belt, and from it down their downy bellies hung a long forbidding cylinder into the top of which was put an ornamental bodkin, bear, and wood. Three, to the wronged lady, Bergman's hero says, I bare my chest to your knife as you open your legs to the blade of my love. Four, a girl gives me a stiletto for letters called Excalibur, saying, there's nothing Freudian, and my wife says, keep it at the office. Five, plowshare, furrow, scabbard, sword, wounded, wounding as language man, old as planting and penetration, metaphors to the quick, warm satin sheath. Vagina sounds like a mill, vagina mill an elevator, or brewery, and cunt sounds like a quiver, Clytemnestra's. The last poem in this book is perhaps, haven't thought of it, a companion piece. It's called, it's called "An Morning In." On a fence post, the rooster simply saying to the sun, our father, hello, old cock, I'm up again, and so are you. The second book begins with this little rhymed poem, Astrology. Pisces is my sign. I don't have to believe it all. To see the fish is mine. Two-way fish without a will, knowing by swimming on, turned tail, turning head, salmon red or white as pine, circling the islands of the dead. Fish, you are my sign. This is called May Letter. The beautiful, small-breasted woman comes in from the rain, wearing those bright, bright and shiny yellow boots, and I think how I love yellow in flower or slickers, and how I love small-breasted women. What a generosity it makes in them of sex and wearing yellow in the rain, and I think, my small-breasted love, of you, the clean and fragrant yellows you wear to bed, daisy, corn, and the delicate yellow down inside of trillium. How the ribbon bright and yellow of women with small breasts, in their rich inversion of what is generous in the things of the world, means they will not fade or fall away from love. Say it. Having lent my apartment to visiting friends, I was sleeping in a strange basement, and I was wakened by a crumb in my ear. I tried to shake it out, tossing my head. No luck. It was not a crumb. Though I didn't know it yet, it was a bug. Not small. So burrowed in, my friend couldn't see it when I finally called her to look. Sweating cold, crazed, thinking of death, feeling it move deeper, gurgling, in and in. I poured water in to drown it and pried it out with a cuticle knife. Pure dread. I was awake for hours. Late the next day, I was telling how fine the previous day had been, how wrong to end like that. And then slowly, and then suddenly, I realized what the thing in my ear had said. It said, listen, this will make you hear what kind of day it was. Slow and warm and fine, a 2-mile run in the rain, a new book on the great Jefferson begun, people pleased with your own book, proofs, children laughing, calling, and most good, and at the start of your fifth decade, most strange, a beautiful woman loves you so, the dank corners lighten. Listen, how she came to you at noon with love, how you went to her at night for love, and found the light was in you, singing. I couldn't hear it until now, the brown, ugly, implacable bug saying, pay attention. This is back of any perfect day, madness, the child's death, and will not stop, and saying by the difference, will you hear now which side of days you have? Then thank a mystery that speaks your name, thank every trick in your ear, and listen. This is called His Oyster. You remember the agenbite or agenbite of inwit is that old way of saying remorse of conscience or to be bitten again by looking inward. I use it in a crazy way. I don't want you thinking about it when we get there. I think the rest needs no explanation if you've ever tried to open an oyster. It's called his oyster. He lives in Washington, D.C., and he goes all the way to Georgia by car, passing through Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, then through part of Georgia on his way down to Savannah. Then he goes by bus through Savannah to Vernon View. Then he goes by boat across bays and inlets and sounds of the Atlantic to Ossabaw Island. Then he goes by station wagon to the main house. Then he goes by pickup truck with Mr. Jimmy Willard Perkins, nicknamed Middleton, to a tidal river to fish 2 hours for trout with no luck. Then he goes by foot with Middleton 1 mile downriver through the woods to an oyster bed Middleton knows about, and there he finds an oyster, or a hard gray-brown shell covered with little stones and carbuncles that looks like it could be an oyster. He knows there is something in it he wants. He takes a razor-sharp knife that has come from Sweden for this, via Sears in D.C., trips to Maine, Vermont, and he tries to open this thing which has the brave, angry face of a petrified knish. It will not open. He takes a stone and taps easy, then hard, on the base of the handle, trying to drive it into the oyster. It doesn't work. The oyster slips away sideways. He tries again and fails again, and then he blows up and puts it on a big flat rock and pounds it with a stone, just trying to smash it, and that doesn't work. And he picks the son of a bitch up and throws it down as hard as he can, and he thinks, well, now would be a goddamned good time for a miracle, for it to roll over and just open slowly. And teach him something about the futility of violence, the shame of pride, the pride of anger, the surprise of faith, where not to knock by Christ is opened wide. Instead, it stays tighter than a bull's ass in fly time. Teaching him the horseshit of inwit, the again bite and fuck you of fantasy, and the true kryptonite hardness of an oyster you can't have, even if you're Clark Kent and have driven 600 miles to get it. Middleton spits some honey cut and says, "That's fucking oysters." This is called Shoe. It's about an old woman I met at an artist colony, and she was 80 or past, and she was the most extraordinary woman perhaps I've ever met. She was compelling, magnetic, and sexy, and she had noisy shoes. It's called Shoe. I'm at a kind of country inn and get to know the shoes and walking sounds of complete strangers. I wouldn't notice this but for an old woman here, all of whose shoes squeak. What makes an old woman's shoes squeak? Where she lives and walks, is there heavy dew which does something to leather? Maybe she lives in a city and walking on concrete flattens them but tunes their resistance. Old or new, they sound like leather feet. Even the slippers, leather on leather. So, squeak is the wrong word. Too timid, high, mousy, too squeaky. The exact sound, especially from the black capizios, is the sound from a western saddle when you put all your weight in the first stirrup. It's as if her big German feet fear a Chinese indignity, and so always get into shoes a size too big. Her feet slide and catch in them as if hostile to walking on other skins, or as if angry with all dependencies that strap us to our bindings. The poor leather in those old shoes. How long has it been unpliant, walked into stiffness by stiffness? And the poor old unreconciled leather of those poor old feet, still raging, maybe, at a lover's obsession with a long second toe. She has a look of kindness in her face, but even there is something raw and unsettled. At 80, some sexual hunger or anger or hurt never settled. There is a hard grace, too, in her size and erectness. She has hands like a stevedore and wears a man's hat. So she enters, her shoes squawking, as if under her dignity they say for her, "Of course my shoes make noises. Who are you? Do you know how many miles I've walked? What things I've had to walk on? What I've stepped in, walked in upon, accidentally or deliberately kicked? Forgive or not the cowhide noises of an old woman's feet. I have walked so far, and I want to walk so far. Angels can walk in gravel and make no noise. But here is a woman who has settled with specific gravity into leather of her mortal flesh, a life that has grown through its subcutaneous muffling and into the bone. If death himself slipped in one day when she was dozing and tried to take back the shoes, she jumped up scared and angry and yelling to keep them, and she goes on in that terrible fury to live, which survives and will survive her dead, outrageous, noisy feet. The last poem from the book I want to read. I do want to read some new ones, though I've used up most of my promised 35 minutes. This is called Paint. Maybe you'll be interested in this. This was a young painter named Phil Rosenthal. I met him at Yaddo. He was 22, as I say, and John Cheever was there. Cheever was 62. And the kid was there at about the same age Cheever was when he first had gone to Yaddo. And they recognized each other. The kid didn't know anything about Cheever's writing, I think, but they recognized talent. And it was lovely to watch them. They went skiing together and snowshoeing. Well, it's quite irrelevant to the poem, but I thought you might be interested. It's called Paint. He's 22 and left everything to come here and paint. And this morning he thinks he wants to paint the sunrise again. So he must get up at 4:30 to gather and ready his gear. Canvas, portable easel, a paint box with many paints and brushes, because he can't anticipate exactly the colors and textures of sunrise, and he knows that, and that is part of what he likes about painting it. He knows the best place in this frozen town for watching the winter sunrise. It is the top floor of a girls' dormitory on the campus of a formerly all-women's college. He looks like a student himself, and he knows it, and knows he will have no trouble getting in. And anyhow, he is carrying all that unrefusable zeal and equipment, and has those bright, sun-hungering eyes, slightly crazed. The guard mistakes him for an ordinary part of the bright, cold, ordinary morning. Jesus, these kids are something. I mean, they never sleep, eh? And they're screwing all the time. I had a kid come up there at 5 in the morning, says he ain't got a girl here, says he's a painter. Are you ready for this? Says he's going to paint the sunrise. Bullshit. But he is, and he is all set up in time, and he is ready when the sun begins, bright-eyed and nuts in his clarity. Everything ready, very happy about what he thinks he is, which happens this time to be exactly what he is. 10 stories of beautifully sleeping girls he has ascended through, to find himself right here on this perfect scaffolding of drowsing arms and legs, the lovely heads turned this way or turning, light and dark, shining and tousled, all size and shapes of hollows and color, resting and waiting too. And he is ready for the sunrise, all his brushes and colors ready. Now, these are new, that is, since those books. Most of them will be in the new book. About 4 years ago, I began writing some poems with a persona, new for me, suspicious of the persona. In fact, I had a poem once that began, "In the first place, by God, I am not a persona, Roland Flint, and I mean just what you're reading." By the way, I think that's a persona to do that, establishes one. But anyway, I got off onto this kick. I think it explains itself. Wolf's is a chain of delicatessens in New York. All of the titles go right into the poem. They began all crazy, and another weight pulled them a different way after a while. He didn't even know he was a pigeon. until the day in New York City when he'd left the rented nest and her, he's often called a nest, and was walking bad hungover from the pre-wedding bash to his favorite Wolf's, 52nd and 7th, for bagel, egg, and aspirin. And his path was blocked by pigeons, and then just one, fat, rumpled, grouchy, clumsy. And he and the pigeon did a little dance before finding the paths around, and he thought, oh God, I danced like that last night at the fancy dinner, dressed just like a pigeon in the rented tux, colliding with the bride's mother, saying some dumb pigeon Yiddish, and pigeon dancing, drunk and bumbling, stumbling by, pigeon, plain as pigeon. Well, that's how they got started. God bless invention, Pigeon says, because when his lady's broken thigh was, though mending, muscle knotted like a fist, her size, and as she lay beside him after dinner having tea, kneading it gingerly with her left hand, then invention came a little, giving him the metal teapot, hot, but not too hot through the sheet, to iron the knot out, steady and hard, agitatum anantropo, for half an hour. Pigeon says God bless it, because her leg felt better all night to let her sleep for a change, and also bless invention for the way she rubbed him back. Now there's a rub by God. God bless it too, and does. An editor from Buzzard Press writes to the Pigeon saying, thanks for sending the poems as requested. We're shooting 7 back, but one we really like, and enclose a copy with a number of changes we think would make the poem stronger. It's a little 28-line versicle. Pigeon worked his tail off on as usual, and these guys suggest 21 changes. 21.